Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 56 of the Carpcast. How are we, Mark, on this fine Sunday?
I'm getting a feeling of deja vu, you know, because the last time we recorded, I was just thinking, let's just get this damn thing done, then I can go fishing. And right now I'm thinking, let's just get this damn thing done, because I'm going fishing again. So come, sorry up.
Well,
get it down.
That's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing at all. I've been looking at the catches over this last week, and it seems from the new moon last weekend and all this week, everywhere seems to have fished pretty well. I only normally start my autumn campaign about now, because if I'm fishing a lake where I'm fishing for, like, you know, the A team of fish, generally I haven't got a syndicate this year, but if I have, I've normally joined it to try and catch a few fish. I mean, there's three types of lakes I like fishing. There's complete pleasure, which can be for anything. It can be, you know, I just want to go fishing and catch whatever's there, you know, just catch as much as possible. Type two is if you join a lake that's just got lots of decent sized fish, maybe not anything stand out, but, you know, you're just trying to catch, you know, a decent amount of what's in there. I would only join a lake, you know, the equivalent of that type of lake now would be a lake that's maybe got 10 40s in, 15 40s, maybe they only go to 45, but there's quite a lot of 40s and a decent head of 30s. If I fish that type of lake, you know, you're just looking for bites and obviously, you know, for the odd chance of a multiple hit. And then you might join a lake that's got maybe one or two big ones in and whatever backup fish, doesn't really matter. Now, if I'm fishing that type of lake, I don't really want to catch those big ones at low weights. I know you've got a bit of form for that, Mark, because you don't get a lot of time in the autumn as a rule, but I try and fish those lakes in the spring and in the summer when the fish are at the best weights, because I think if you join a lake that's got a 50 in it, yes, you know, it's still meritorious if you catch it at £47, but you join that lake to catch a 50 because it's got a 50 in. You don't really want to catch it at 47. I know it's still a great achievement and you can't always pick and choose, but I'll try and engineer it so that I catch it at a decent weight as a rule. And for that reason, I don't really fish in the summer. I'll maybe fish the other two types of lakes in the summer, stuff for pleasure and whatever. But I remember when I fished St. Ives, we were fishing for the Fat Lady, and Daryl caught it the first week in September, and it was when there weren't many 50s in the country, and there was only maybe one or two that are actual accessible 50s that you could join, and St. Ives was maybe the only one. There might have been one other, but you know, lakes that you could actually put your name on the list and join and get on. It was there, so a 50 pounder was a really big fish then, you know, the equivalent of catching a 60 now for sure. And he caught it at 49 on the first week of September, and while he was obviously still chuffed, it was a, you know, 60 70 nights fishing, whatever he did for it, and he caught well out of there. He had to be a bit disappointed. It was £49. That's a fact of life. He still made up. He caught a lady. He moved on. Caught shitloads of big fish since. So, you know, it's neither in nor there. But he joined a lake to catch one of the only accessible 50s in the country and didn't catch it at 50. And I've always tried to avoid that situation. Early September, I mean, that fish, nobody really knew how much it spawned out. I mean, it spawned out, it had been like £56 earlier in the year, or 55. So nobody thought it'd be 49. You know, first week in September, but it was. So I normally start my autumn campaign about the 8th, 9th, 10th of September, something like that, usually after the kids go back to school, so have the summer holidays doing family stuff, and then, you know, I'll get my autumn head on in usually, like say, around the 7th, 8th, 9th September, something like that. And I'm kind of hoping that I don't catch the big one straight away. You know, I'm kind of, every session that goes by, I know it's going to be at a decent weight. So I don't know if that's right or wrong. I don't know if you would call me a target hunter or whatever the names people use derogatory for people.
Bounty hunter,
trophy hunter, whatever. Yeah. I mean,
this is where we do differ a bit, man, because I think the fish is more important than the number we degrade them with at the end of it. Yeah,
I'm not sure though, because I don't think you'd have bought that ticket if it didn't have a 50 in.
I'd have bought that ticket anyway.
Maybe the St. Ives one, but you know, this
big thing. You know, the end result is the fish. But yeah, I mean, we both caught it the same year. I had it the 1st of August, 46. You had it the 1st of November, 12 pound bigger, 58.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I mean, you can't always choose. You know, you still have obviously made up when you catch it. But at the end of the day, if that lake held 5 30 pounders and a 50. Right, you're going to join it to catch the 50. I mean, that's an equivalent now of having, you know, six upper 30s and a 60, right? If that lake held six upper 30s and a 47, you might still join it, but it wouldn't be I have to take that ticket. And by catching it in the summer, that's the equivalent of what you're doing.
I've just realised the hypocrisy of me saying that. I've just put my name down on a waiting list and a syndicate with a 50 in that I want to catch, so...
I mean, that's like, you know, 12, 13, 14 years ago, was it? We fished Elstow, and that's the equivalent of... You know, joining the lake's got a 50, and that was the equivalent of us joining Elstow back then that had a scrape.
I caught that spawned out as well.
Yeah, I mean, you don't fish. You always have a big long holiday in the autumn, and you probably do more fishing in the summer. I mean, I just don't bother fishing my main lake in the summer. I just don't bother for reasons I expected. Call me a bounty hunter, call me a trophy hunter, but at the end of the day, you're paying. You know, I'm usually driving 3 or 4 hours. It costs 150 quid a week to go fishing with some bait, food, and fuel. To travel down south, you're quite often paying 500, 800, a grand, 1500 quid in some cases for a ticket, which is what averaging out at another £100 a session probably for your ticket, depending on how much you're paying for it. So it's costing 200 to 300 quid to go fishing. Now you're doing that because it's got a 50 in it. So to catch that fish at 45, yeah, you've still caught the fish. Well done. But I don't know. I mean, that's what you've paid that money for. So I'm going to do everything I possibly can to catch it away. At the end of the day, the reason why we're big fish hunting is to catch big fish. You know, you're either a big fish hunter or you're not. If you're going to be a big fish hunter, then you want to catch them fish at optimum times, surely.
Yeah, well, of course. We all want big fish. If we weren't bothered about size, then we'd still be sat on the canal catching little roach and gudgeon.
That's my point. That's where it gets, you know, hypocritical when people are, I don't really mind, I caught the fish, it was 41, you know, but you wouldn't have joined that lake to catch a 41. You know, if it's a normal 50.
Yeah. It reminds me of a conversation we've had where you said, what are you fishing Icon for when, you know, the biggest fish I'm going to catch out there is a low, possibly mid 30? It's because it's fun. You know, that has got to be the key word. I've got to enjoy where I'm fishing. And I've dropped tickets, you know, in the past where there has been fish, one in particular, a really old, desirable common, just because I didn't enjoy fishing that lake. It was a pain in the arse, you know. The fish is there, it's an absolutely stonking fish, but I didn't enjoy the fishing.
Yeah, you've got to enjoy what you're doing, and you know, I've joined and fished lakes, bloody hell, you know, this year I've fished day ticket lakes where there's nothing bigger than £20 in there and gone on there for 2 nights. You know, I'm love fishing when I'm fishing, but I also, there's no more excitement I get than when I'm hunting a really big fish. You know, as you're going to hear in this is it in this episode?
Lee Jackson, isn't it?
Lee Jackson, yeah. The buzz he talks about, I think it's actually in his greatest achievements in this week's, or in the latest episode of the Carpcast Extra. Season 2, Episode 1 is currently out on our website, www.thecarpcast.com. And Lee said that there's a buzz. You know, he was sat there, while there's some other decent fishing, Colin Brooker, there was, you know, there was some nice 40-pounders in there. You were fishing for a British record. You were fishing for the biggest fish in the land. And the buzz that gave you is, he said, is like no other buzz. You know, I used to think, you know, when we sat there fishing for the lady and, you know, there's a mid-50 swimming about in front of you, that magic of just thinking, even if you're nowhere near it or whatever, just thinking, there's a 55-pounder swimming about out there somewhere. That excitement, you know, big fish fishing is not for everybody. That I like that bit of not catching, you know, doing 20 blank nights in a row. For that excitement of if something picks me bait up, it could be £50. And I would enjoy that way more than fishing a well-stocked lake, a heavy stock lake that's got a 50-pounder in it, where you're getting a bite, you know, you're expecting of 2 or 3 bites a day. I would much rather be on the low-stock lakes where I'm working hard for every bite than ploughing my way through 60 fish a season in the hope that one of them screamers is the 50. Yeah. It's just what excites me. But I think if you're going to do that, you want to catch them, you know, at the biggest weights. We've rambled and ranted again, haven't we?
Yeah, we've got absolute. You know, I don't know why I bother doing these notes. They just get ignored.
Well, as far as my fishing, I haven't actually got an autumn campaign anywhere. I'm contemplating it. I have a plan or two. Probably my next serious session is going to be on Kevin Nash's lake, which I'm extremely excited about. I'm going down there to do some work. We're interviewing Gary Bayes while I'm there, doing another Nash debate while I'm there, and seeing all the new product. They've got like a showroom set up currently where they're inviting all the reps from around the world and all the shop owners and stuff come down, check out the products for next year. And I'm quite excited to go down and see all that. Hopefully catch some fish while I'm at it. Taking Roger Bacon with me as well. He's coming down there to hopefully catch some carps.
Are you going to interview Roger while you're down there? I think you should stick a mic in front of the pair of you. That could be an interesting chat, because Roger has he's a brilliant angler and he's got some good ideas as well.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely going to interview Roger, whether I'll do it that week. Bear in mind, we've got quite a busy, even though we're going to be there 4 or 5 days at least. I've got quite a lot on in that 4 or 5 yeah. days, and I wouldn't mind catching some fish. But to be honest, one evening, if we sat there having a beer, then it's a decent chance that might happen, to be honest. So, yes, that's not a bad shout. Should we do DNA Baits? DNA Baits have sponsored us since the start. They were our very first supporter of the show, and we'd like it if you support them. Talking of DNA, Roger has had a mega hit this week from the lake he's fishing, Grenville. He took our friend Saul, Scottish Saul, who's involved with the Scottish Carp Group up there. He took Saul down and on a guest session, and Saul had 10 fish on this first day, I think.
Oh.
It went crazy. You know, couldn't keep a rod in the water. Saul had fish to 44-pound. Roger had a load of fish too. And I know he swears by the S7, which is a DNA bait. You can get extra discounts on all the stuff at DNA Baits by using the code CARPCAST5. Go to dnabaits.com and use the discount code CARPCAST5 at checkouts for all their post-free deals. That's what they're known for. They do fluoro deals, fluoro wafter deals, 5 key boilie deals. Is 2 options, one that has a litre of your choice of liquid, all come with boilies and hook baits. There's a 10 key deal, even a 50 kilo freezer bait deal, which can be split into 2 different sizes. You get the cork dust wafters, cork dust pop-ups, and a litre of hydro wheat or beta stim. It's £320, that one, delivered straight to your door. And as I said, you can get an extra 5% off that using the code CARPCAST5 at the checkout, dnabaits.com. and a big thank you for supporting us for probably over a year now. Thank you very much. I just mentioned Scotland. I mentioned Scotty Saul. Did you see that the chap that had the 40 pounder out of the lock has caught another one, upped the Scottish record? Same chap from the same venue. Did you see that?
I have. You said it was a different fish, but I've also seen a report it was the same one. Do we know which one's right?
I don't know that. I do know there is a story of it in this week's Carp Talk. We'll be doing the Carp Talk advert towards the end. In the Carp Talk advert, it says it's the same fish, 2 pound heavy at 45 and a half. So yeah, apparently it is the same carp. What a feat that would have been if it was a different fish.
Yeah, what a lake. North of the wall.
North of the wall, yes. As I said previously, let's claim it. Let's beat the wall. It's English. Sorry, all my Scottish friends.
Yeah, we need to send a nice watch up there and, you know, get rid of all the wildlings, make sure the White Walkers don't catch the fish. And if you don't watch Game of Thrones, you have no idea what I'm talking about.
I've not started watching it yet. I cannot watch it unless I illegally download it. Of all the millions of Netflixy type things I have, I don't have access to Game of Thrones, so I don't know what I'm going to do about that. But anyway, I'd like to give a shout out to James Barter. As we are talking, James Barter's PayPal has just come through. He must be a Carpcast fan because he's just booked the Christchurch social with Frank Warwick, which is the 8th of October, that weekend there, Friday to Sunday. He's just booked that. He's bought a Carpcast beanie and a Knowledge DVD bundle. So, James Barter, big up yourself. Thank you very much. If you want to join him on the Christchurch social, we've got Frank Warwick, we've got the Fired Up Barbecues, big social on the Saturday night. We'll have a few beers. Frank will be giving guidance all weekend. And it's a cracking time of year to get on Christchurch. Talking of a lake that's got a lot of 40 pounders in, I think there's around 20 40 pounders with a number of upper 40s, including commons. It might even do a 50 this autumn. It's been knocking on the door for the last couple of years. We have the lake exclusively booked at a prime time of year, and you can get all your food for the weekend, all the coaching, access to the lake, and you'll be joining James Barter and others. Only 250 quid. You can purchase that on the Carpcast website, or www.thecarpcast.com, where you can also get the DVD bundle that he bought, or the beanie, or a hoodie, or a t-shirt. And we know that you catch more in the Carpcast giveth t-shirts, don't we? The Carp Gods give us a t-shirt. You definitely catch
more. Yes. It pleases the gods.
We always want to please the carp gods, yeah. Yeah. Anything on the net this week?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah, I'll start with this one. This is fresh off the news, so to speak. I'm looking at Rob Hughes at Facebook from 1 hour ago, and it was the final of the BCAC today. Now, we don't usually put catch reports or match results in because there are just simply too many. But I've put this one in. Kev Hewitt and Mark Bartlett have won. But what this does, not only are they brilliant anglers, England internationals, it makes Mark Bartlett British champ, European champ, and world champ all at the same time.
That's pretty amazing. Talking of Rob, I had a good 45 minutes catch up with Rob. We haven't had a Hughes news for quite some time, so let's get the man himself on now. Rob Hughes.
Hughes News.
So I'd like to welcome Mr. Rob Hughes of Hughes News fame. It's been a while since we've spoken here, Rob.
I think we've both been busy bods, haven't we, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's summer away for me. I know you've been busy here, there and everywhere.
Yeah, a lot of practice, actually, for the World Champs. That sort of dominated. I didn't have a summer away. I managed to get 3 days holiday this year. With the family, that was it. They went without me for 10 days and I managed to join them for 3. Right. So, yeah, a little bit tough on the personal time, but you know, the fishing and more to the point fishing organisation time has been going pretty well.
Well, as the busiest man in carp fishing, I expect nothing less. How's it going with the TV stuff, the BT Sports? How's that kind of evolved since we last spoke?
Very good. We're obviously weekly, every Monday at 7 p.m. on BT Sport 2. And it's gone really, really well, to be honest. The everything that's gone out so far has been sport report based, so primarily fishing matches. We're starting now to come into the carp side of things. Obviously, this weekend is the British Carp Angling Championships that we're out filming. And then the week after that will be the World Carp Classic, which I'm heading straight over from Raisbury over to Austria to get in a car to drive to Brno in the Czech Republic to cover the World Carp Classic. So we'll be having some carp programming on soon. But yeah, it's gone really, really well, to be fair, Jay. You know, it's always a bit nervy when you start something new, and moving from one channel to another, we weren't sure how it's going to be received, what the audience is like, what's the channel going to receive it like. And the long and short of it, it's been really good. And one of the big things which is quite interesting is that, having put a few international events on, we covered the World Feeder Championships, the European Float Championships, a few other bits and bobs like that, they've rolled us onto Europe as well. So the European channel is getting it now, and it was quite well received there. So all of the fishing stuff's going across Europe as well as the UK too. So yeah, very, very good indeed.
Fantastic. Something we mentioned on last week's show, actually, were you there for the match this?
Yes, last week. Yes, I was.
Did you have an opinion? I know you're normally very diplomatic, but the lake's got KHV. Do you have an opinion on that? On the match going ahead and stuff?
Yeah, I absolutely have an opinion on it. And this is something that I think CFAS have got to look into. If you know anything about KHV, you'll know that it generally tends to hit match venues. And what it tends to do is kill quite a few of the fish. The ones that survive are okay. There's a quarantine period. You know, and as with any lake that suffers a fish kill, the fish need to be rested. For whatever, you know, and even if it doesn't suffer a fish kill, there's times where weather conditions are pretty tough. Atmospherics last week were really bad, and the week before, and I know a number of places that suffered losses, not as a result of KHV, just as a result of, you know, very high pressure that took the oxygen out of the water and it caused one or two fish deaths. Sadly, I lost one in, well, I actually lost four in my own pond up in Shropshire. Again, nothing KHV related, but it's all about fish care. And this is the key. I've got a number of opinions on match fishing that we'll come to in a minute. But firstly, on this individual occurrence, that diagnosis was 2 weeks before the press release went out on it.
Right.
Now, CFAS, and I think they need to organise themselves with regards to their press releases. Because the facts, as far as I'm aware, is that there was a diagnosis of fish deaths on there that was suggested to be a KHV. It might have been, it might not have been, but let's say it was. It was a couple of weeks before, and the notification, what happens is, as soon as something, a KHV notification goes out, the fishery is shut, and there's a quarantine period for 2 weeks, straight away, that's what happens. That happened, the fishery was shut, it then passed its quarantine and was reopened. And would you believe it, talk about timing, and I'll bring the Environment Agency and Otters into this as well with their press release timings. CFAS actually released the notification press release the day before match this was due to take place on a diagnosis that took place 2 weeks before.
Wow.
Now, that can't be right.
No.
Now, unfortunately, a lot of people didn't know that. And what they've seen is that, you know, and I think a lot of that traffic came through my page because it was me that posted it. A lot of carp anglers aren't really aware of the match scene, but because I cross over and cover them all, then a lot of carp anglers now are getting a view into and a window into the match scene with some of the postings that I put up. And it was me that said, match this is on. And lo and behold, somebody's put on there that you know, it's designated KHV. It was, but it was 2 weeks before.
Mm.
So it's gone through its quarantine period. Now, if you've gone through your quarantine period, then you can open again, and that's what they did.
There's opening and there's having a match where these fish are going to get battered for a weekend, though, aren't they? Two different things.
Absolutely, there is. And what you can do is you can go on to you know, suggested government guidelines as to what you can and can't do. Now, I think that there needs to be a lot more movement in the match world about fish care, and it's something that I've insisted be brought in with regards to Fishermania in particular, that now they have to have unhooking mats. I've suggested it to match this. I've also suggested it to the UK Championships. And because we televise these events, what I'm saying is that from next year, and it was a suggestion for this year, but it will be a rule of mine next year, that we have unhooking mats, so when the fish are brought out in the nets, they put onto an unhooking mat, not sometimes put onto the grass or the ground, whatever, that we have to look at net limits, and we have to be tighter on net limits, that match fishing really needs to have a look at itself and think about its fish care. And I get that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you must have seen Holmes's post. It wasn't Holmes's post, actually. It was Des's post. Des Taylor. Obviously, you know, the carp anglers getting involved in this because it's predominantly carp that are caught in these matches these days.
Yeah.
I know it's F1s a lot of the time, which are not sort of the carp that we fish for, the smaller ones, but they're still carp, and carp anglers get passionate about seeing something, you know, species they treat to the highest possible standard, you know, handled, you know, like hundreds and hundreds of pounds of carp in a net that are all dragged out, the weight of each other on top of each other, dumped on the floor unceremoniously. You know, it doesn't look pretty. And that, if that doesn't look pretty to a carp angler, it sure as hell ain't looking pretty to a non-angler, which are, you know, one of our biggest enemies. And the, it was the volume of fish that was caught on this match. Des was going on about, somebody actually worked it out, it meant a 4 pound carp was being caught every second for the entire match, and that was just
That was that ridiculous 1400 pound net down in Coleman's Cottage, it was somewhere down south, wasn't it? It was a southeast venue that had a ridiculous number of fish caught. And you know, again, I saw a post about that, there was quite a few people that raised that. It wasn't match this, it wasn't UK champs,
no, it was still a match fishing
it
for
was
carp.
A match. Yeah. And that fishery owner now, actually, I saw a post in Angling Times about that. That fishery owner now has actually agreed that, you know, his lake is overstocked and that there's going to be some sort of sanction brought in. And this is where I think what we have to do is we have to take a look at ourselves. And it's very easy to criticise. And believe me, I will criticise. There's no problem with that whatsoever. It's very easy to criticise. But what we need to do is we need to take a look at ourselves. And carp anglers took a look at themselves a long time ago, and I will permanently drive everywhere that I go that carp fishermen look after their fish more than anyone else. We're much more aware of the environment. Our fishery management is better than everyone else's. And if any match anglers out there want to come and have an argument with us about it, then feel free. You know, I straddle both. I see how sea anglers treat their fish. I see how coarse anglers treat their fish. If you look at the way carp anglers and carp angling venues look after their quarry, that is the way that the majority of other disciplines in the sport should look to the standard that they should attain as well. And with regards to some of these match fisheries, yes, we all want to catch fish. And we've got the likes of Brasenose, where you can go out and catch loads and loads of fish, fair enough, but we return them all straight away. What is the challenge in going out and catching 200 or 300 pound plus of fish? None at all. And if it is purely just a case of you racing against the man that's next door to you to catch the biggest net that you possibly can, which is effectively what a match is, but there is no element of skill in it, it is literally just down to a speed race because there's so many fish in there, then something should be done about it. And I, for one, would like to try and get involved with the match angling fraternity to look at just bringing a little bit of sensibility back into match weights, fish care, the way that the whole match situation is run. Not from the competitive side of things, rules-wise, brilliant, but let's have a little bit more of a look at how many fish you're putting in nets and what you're doing. So, effectively, we're arguing the same point.
Yeah, the matches, in my opinion, shouldn't be an endurance test, which is what they seem to be at the minute. Who can literally drag them in the quickest part? I mean, you know, that particular match we were, Desmond highlighted, you know, the winner had £1,500, second place had £1,300. That just tells you everything. I mean, he then made a post later on saying that he's been speaking with Angling Times and another of other places, and they've agreed to destock some waters to make to cap it at like £200 as the maximum. I mean, that's still too many, I think. When I match fished as a kid, I mean, it was, you want to be in the position where just squeezing that extra bite is the difference between you and the next guy. Not can I catch 10 in a minute.
you're entering match fishing keep it real circles now. And that goes on, believe me, that goes on in the match world. For example, let's look at Keep It Real English. We've got natural or relatively natural waters with relatively low stock of carp, and it's man hunting carp. That's what we're doing. Then let's have a look at commercial day ticket waters where there's lots in there because people go out, catch a few fish, really enjoy themselves. Location wise, don't really have to think about it because they're all over the place. What you've got to do is you've got to get your bait and tactics better than the next door neighbour and try and encourage his fish to feed on your spot. That's effectively what's happening with match fishing now because they have the commercial. They have the carp puddles, as they call them, where rather than going out on the river and catching 3.5 pound of dace, or rather than going out on the river and catching, if you're lucky, a couple of big chub and boosting yourself into a double figure net, people will go out and they'll catch 100 pound bags. And maybe 10 years ago, 100 pound bag was a massive amount. Then suddenly 200 pound bags came in and they're sort of relatively normal. And I think now, as soon as you start going over and above that, that is far, far too much.
Yeah, there's no argument for that.
The other thing is that to make that sort of a weight up, to make 200 pounds up in realistically a 4 or 5 hour match, you know, you're catching 40 or 50 pounds an hour. Now, 40 or 50 pounds an hour, if you think about it, what's that? If it's 50 pounds an hour, that's £10 every 12 minutes.
It's almost a pound a minute, yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. So that means that you're going to be targeting carp.
Yeah.
And to keep that sort of weight going, you're going to be targeting carp of realistically £6 plus. And if you're targeting carp of £6 plus, I feel that as soon as a carp gets to £6, £8, £10 absolutely maximum, it shouldn't really be put in a keep net. Or if it is being put in a keep net, there should be one or maybe two more with it. And you certainly shouldn't have more than two or three fish in a keep net.
Yeah, this particular one with the 1,400, 1,500 pounds, I mean, I believe the average size was pretty big. So you can imagine 1,400 pounds worth of 6 to 10 pounders in a keep net. There is no good thing that can happen lifting them out of the water, placing them on the ground. The whole bit of it makes me feel sick.
That's right. But this is where I come back to my point from a moment ago. What we have to do is we have to take a look at ourselves, because any fishery or any business will only supply what a customer wants. And if the customer wants it, they'll carry on doing it, and they'll carry on doing it because they can make money out of it. Now, it's wrong from the fisheries point of view, but like we turn around and say an awful lot of things, and you can liken this to any venues. Excuse me. If the venue isn't providing what the customer wants, then the customer shouldn't go there. It's as simple as that. Because, you know, it's
being endorsed publicly, though, with these matches and the publicity and the filming of them, that's the problem. Like, a normal guy isn't going to go and rip the head off a 10-pounder catching one a second, you know, getting it in as quick as possible. He's going to catch that 10-pounder, do whatever he's doing with it, put his rod out, catch it again. You know, it's these matches under pressure, competition for money, then being televised with trophies. That's what's that's where the problem is on these venues. It's just endorsement.
Yeah, I sort of get it. I sort of get that. But at the same time, you know, that £1,400 match, that wasn't a televised match. So if I look at the matches that I televise, and we televise three big ones in the UK in particular, which is Match This, that's the one that was on over the weekend that was a £70,000 prize. We televise Fishermania, and we also televise the UK Champs, or I'm involved in Fishermania, should I say. That's a Barry Hearn production. And also the Parkdean Masters, which is another big money match. Now, anything over £100 in these is normally a big bag.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is a relative degree of sensibility there. But look, it's something that fortunately now the debate has been opened, and what we can do is we can push it forwards. One thing that's a double-edged sword as far as these matches are concerned is Facebook Live. And it's very, very interesting, the amount of people that are wandering around at these events now when it comes to the weigh-in with their cameras on, and they're reporting live as to exactly what's going on. Now, brilliant for the viewer because he can see what the weights are, etc., etc. But what it does is it shows actually what goes on. And, you know, there are times where you think, blimey, that needs a little bit more care, this needs a little bit more care. And I think with the angling world being on show now, they've got to take notice. Because, like you say, quite rightly so, if anglers are taking a look at these things and going, actually, we don't like that, we're uncomfortable with it, what do non-anglers do? And, you know, 20 years ago, the photographs of the big shoals of bream from Ireland, 100-pound bags in keep nets of bream, 2 and 3 pound bream, great big bulging nets there. They were the trophy shot that everybody wanted.
Yeah.
That's what people wanted to do. And eventually what they decided to do was make it a little bit nicer on the fish by putting a ground sheet underneath the keep net on the rocks. and suddenly it's like, oh, it's all right, there's a ground sheet underneath it. In fact, there's 150 pound of bream stuffed in a keep net battering against each other and you know, no padding. Didn't make any difference, but they got the ground sheet down, so that made it better, or a tarpaulin or a canvas or whatever it was. But actually, things are getting better. And I think what we need to do now is we need to push it forward. In this day of modern media, we need to push it forward that, look, there are some regulations that need to be brought in. And it's been interesting seeing the feedback that's been coming in off the Facebook Live posts, and also with my involvement a little bit more this year through the TV side of things. Definitely things need tidying up, and I will be pushing for that with all of these big events. And I think if the big events start doing it, hopefully it will be dropping back through the other events as well, that they will all need to bring in some element of carp care or fish care.
You're in the pole position to do this. I mean, you're involved in a lot of these events with the production side of it. You're also representing the sport of fishing for Sport England. I mean, you're in the position to do it. You know, it kind of needs to be. It's why I've had this conversation with you. It's you that needs to be driving this stuff, and you need to start with the venues and the anglers, because, you know, this is being televised. We want to make fishing more popular. We want, you know, people watching it to not go, oh, is that fair on the fish? You know, it's that can only benefit the sport long term.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we're on it. We're on it.
Your name came up in conversation over the summer, actually. I had a trip to Luke Moffitt's place, as you may or may not know. We had a disaster session, as did the people on the weeks after us, suffered exactly the same thing, I found out, and the people in the weeks preceding us, with Luke basically making most of the lake where the fish were residing unfishable to us, but still expecting the full value of the money. He basically sold us something that we only had a percentage of what he sold us, but didn't want to knock a percentage off the money. Now, two things. One, you used to own a holiday company, so I guess you have an opinion on this generally. But secondly, he actually cited you as a reason why we couldn't just leave and not pay him, because he said, oh, Rob Hughes has got to give me 1,500 quid if he ever wants to come back again, because he cancelled a trip on me last year because I'd roped off the bay because there was too much weed in the bay or something, he said. So he'd roped off an area. The fish were in there as a safe haven. And he said, you said you weren't coming after giving him a 1,500 quid deposit. And he said you were never going back unless you paid him that 1,500 quid.
Right. That's an interesting one. Well, there's two points. Firstly, he is absolutely correct. We paid him a deposit and we cancelled. I certainly wasn't going to give him any more money than that, because the situation was that we wanted a full lake. There's a German and an Austrian friend of mine who wanted to go there. We decided to go. It was my birthday trip in November, actually, so we decided to go down for that. And, you know, I don't get an awful lot of time for my own personal fishing, unfortunately, but I always go with a couple of really good friends. November time, we pick somewhere special and we go there. So we've booked Luke's place, and obviously wanted to be in with a chance of a big fish. And just before going over there, I was watching the press, because he wants to know whether the brown fish or the scar has been caught, because actually, you know, really that's what you're going for, those two fish more than anything else. And they weren't being caught, and I didn't see a report, and I'm thinking, brilliant, they haven't come out. And then another week goes by, they haven't come out, and then another week goes by, and then you think, actually nothing's come out. So 3 or 4 weeks before going over, a Dutch mate of mine got in touch and said, there's been hardly anything caught. It's one bite a week at the moment, 3-4 people. The lake's really weedy and he's not letting you fish most of it. And I thought, well, that can't be right. Surely, you know, if you book the lake, and €3,000 is quite a lot of money, if you book the lake, you must be able to get the whole lake. On it went, and still nothing coming out. And a couple of other mates of mine were on. Mark Pitchers was on the week before. He'd had one bite, and I rang him up, and he said exactly the same thing. And it turned out what was happening was you'd turn up, and you'd give your deposit. Sorry, you paid your deposit already. You'd turn up. He'd ask you for your money. You'd pay the final balance, and then he'd tell you where you could and couldn't fish. And he'd walk you around the lake and say, right, you can't fish here, you can't fish there. And at the time when I was supposed to go over there, the whole of the bay was roped off and you weren't allowed to fish the weed in the margins. So effectively what you can do is you can chuck out into open water, where, having spoken to the guys that were on the week before and the week before and the week before that, everyone had said, well, they're all absolutely rammed up in the bay because it's full of weed and nobody's fishing there. Yeah. Well, forgive me, but if I'm booking the whole lake, I would expect the whole lake. So I rang him up and said, can you clarify if this is the case? Because if it's not the case, I'm not going to waste a week of my time coming over to fish for you know, to effectively have what we're not we've booked the whole lake, we want the whole lake, and if you can't give us the whole lake, then clearly you're not going to be giving us what we've originally booked for. And he said, well, don't worry, you know, come over anyway, we'll sort it out, there won't be too much of a problem. I can assure you I'll get the weed sorted on the Saturday. By Saturday afternoon, it'll be fishable. You know, a week of my time is amazingly precious, as it is to everybody's. And I'm just not prepared to spend a week of my time with no chance at all, a week of my time giving that amount of money. And it's not a cheap trip. It's 3,000 euros. Yeah. I'm not going to give 3,000 euros to somebody for something that when I get there, they change the goalposts, so we just don't get. And it's as simple as that. And I had the conversation with him. And it was a case of, well, you know, if we have the full lake, as we've booked, then we'll come. But if we can't have it, then we're not coming. And we couldn't have it, so that was it. I'm not going there. Now, technically, turning around and saying that I've got to give him another 1,500 euros, well, we've already had the conversation about that, and that's not the case at all. It's another 1,500 euros if we want to go back, and 1,500 euros is already had, will be used as my deposit for the next time if I wanted to go back. But the more I hear, the less likely I am to go back, and quite frankly, don't want to go back. And if you're looking at legal proceedings now, and I'll put my legal head on, if you and I contract for something, and I give you a deposit on the basis that you're going to give me A, B, and C, if I then pay you the balance, you have to give me A, B, and C. And if you don't give me A, B, and C, then it is a breach of contract, so I can ask for all of my money back. Now, there's two different types of terms within a contract. There are warranties and there are conditions. Now, conditions of a contract are things that you absolutely have to have. And warranties are things that you should have, but actually this contract can still be performed if you don't get them. So, for example, let's say that you book a hotel and you book bed and breakfast. So you're expecting to have a bed and you're expecting to have breakfast. Now, when you get there, you go to sleep, you go to your bed, no problem whatsoever. You get there for breakfast in the morning, and breakfast is actually a ticket for you to whip down to the supermarket and buy yourself some bacon that you've got to cook for yourself. Now, technically, that's not really the breakfast that you're expecting, but they could say, well, we're still giving you a food voucher, you're being fed.
Yeah.
If they say, well, actually, there's no breakfast at all, you've only got bed, then you're not getting bed and breakfast, you're just getting bed. So as a result, it's a breach of contract, so you would expect something back. Now, if you, likening this on the fishing side of things, if you're going there and you're taking the whole lake, to rent the whole lake, to fish the whole lake, it must be an implied warranty, and indeed a condition, that you get the whole lake and you can fish the whole lake.
Yeah, not only that, with our trip was a mirror image of yours. It's exactly what you've just described there. We had false promises. Oh, don't worry, I'll reopen these parts of the lake while you're here. But we knew they hadn't been open for 5 weeks before we arrived, and they didn't open for another few weeks after we left either. So, and I've heard of people, as you have, having this same problem in the winter as well as the summer. If it gets weedy, just doesn't, the long and short of it is he doesn't want you catching his fish. But you also get use of the second lake. So one of our decisions on the Saturday morning, we're in a hotel 10 minutes away from his lake, and we're like, do we go or do we just go somewhere else? We were thinking about going to Labyrinth up the road, yeah, but like, yeah, an hour away, because we could have took the 1,500 euro. Well, it's gone up now. It's 3,400, not 3,000 currently. So yeah, we owed him 1,900. We'd paid the 15 deposit. And we were like, we can go and have a decent holiday somewhere with this 1,900 euro. He, yeah, sold us false promises, said, oh, don't worry, it'll probably open in a day or two, you know, because it was cool that week. There was no sun. It was overcast. You know, it was like, you know, hoodies at night. It was very cool and raining and stormy. They just weren't going to spawn if they hadn't already spawned. And we thought, oh, well, one of the deciding factors is there's a lake next door. It's got fish to 50 pound. It's an absolute runs water. You can stalk there in the daytimes, have 10, 20 fish a day. When we got there, he was like, oh, you can't have the other lake this week because there's a couple of competition winners. I gave a prize for some competition and they're on this week. So not only did we not get the majority of our lake, and certainly all the bits you wanted to fish, i.e. where the fish were, we didn't even have that other option of having a bit of fun on the other lake either, because
I have a real problem with that, and when I run a holiday company, and we ran Angling International for a number of years, and you know what, some venues are good, some venues aren't good, some venues are difficult, some venues are easy, sometimes the weather's good, sometimes it's not, sometimes they spawn, sometimes they don't, and I get all that, absolutely get all of it, but what really gets under my skin with some of the holiday companies, and I think they've got a lot better now on the whole, but what really gets under my skin with holiday companies is the selling of a false promise, because there's two things that are really important to people: time and money. And money doesn't come around very easily, and time you can't get back. And your average bloke has 4 weeks off work, and he'll probably have 2 weeks with the family because he'll have to. He'll have a week where he'll split it into taking days off for whatever reason, going to kids' sports day, having to take the dog to the vets, all sorts of things, whatever it might be. But there'll be a week where he's splitting it into bits, and there'll be 1 week where he gets to go away with his mates for a week, and he really looks forward to that, and that's his carp fishing trip, that is his time, his get away from everything else, get out of his world, go fishing with his pals. And you've only got to look at how many holiday companies there are. You've only got to look at how many anglers go overseas as to how much that means to those anglers. And to go over on the basis of a false promise, I think, is quite frankly robbery. Because what you're doing is you're stealing the opportunity from that guy for him to have a good time with his mates for that week. And if a venue is being sold on the basis of you get X, and when you get there, you get Y, I just think that's terrible, because the chap doesn't have another chance. Also, he's sacrificed whatever else it is financially to be able to go away on that holiday. And you know, €3,400 as a start, that's not an inconsiderable amount of money. So, you know, it's not like, oh, it's only 30 quid for a week, it's not too bad. You know, it's not like you're nipping down the local day ticket water and it's a pit. And the other thing is that when you're there and you get it wrong, you can't really go anywhere else, because a lot of the time people don't know where else to go. If they did know where else to go, it would be booked. It's the cost involved in it, etc., etc. And the very fact that, if I was a judge in a court case, I would always look for the first thing, and that is motive. What's the motive on what's happened? And for somebody to turn around and the first time you see your customer say, right, I need your balance. You must pay your balance. And then after the balance is paid and you've got the money out of their pocket, then you tell them what they can and can't do. I think that's a problem. Now, if Luke had written to me before, and this is any other venue at all with problems, if the venue has problems and they let the customer know beforehand what the situation is, that customer can make an informed choice and decision as to what they want to do. And if they decide, we'll take a punt, we'll carry on, then fair enough, you know what the circumstances are. You might not like it, but you know what the circumstances are a little bit. But to do it on the day when you're there, saying, actually, oh, it's all changed, it's exactly the same as seeing a photograph in a hotel brochure, or in a holiday brochure, going over to Spain, thinking, this is great, we're on our jollies with the family, getting there, the hotel's half built, you can't use a swimming pool, the restaurant's out of order, there's a load of building work going on, but don't worry, it'll be fine, give us your balance. Right. Not for me, my friend. It's just wrong.
It was actually worse than that for us. Like, I know how paranoid he is about his fish, and I knew that a lot of lakes in England hadn't spawned. So the week before, I chased him to basically say, have the fish spawned? Is there going to be a problem? He didn't contact us. He was going to let us arrive. He played it down. He's like, oh, they'll spawn by the time you get here. They haven't spawned yet. They'll spawn by the time you get here. I chased him all week, which he used against me when we had it out. He's like, oh, you wanted there to be a problem. I was like, no, I just know how paranoid you are. You know, you bollocked people for casting a lead out 30 yards in case you hit a fish. Like, I know you're paranoid about the fish. I accept that. I just want to make sure that we're going to have a fair crack of the whip when we get there. And he just played it down. Oh, don't worry. It's, you know. And then when we got there, he went, right, this is a situation. The margins are closed. And one end of the lake's closed, which is had been the case for weeks, and obviously every fish in the lake is there because they're not getting fish for. It's perfectly safe. They were the happiest looking fish I've ever seen in my life, nutting in open water one after the other, and because they were in a complete safe haven. Yeah, yeah. Not to mention even when you decide, right, well, we're here now, we'll just fish through this ridiculous situation, hopefully we'll get compensated somehow financially or whatever, which didn't happen. It was like Big Brother. He was followed us. I mean, he was in England for a lot of the week we were there, and he was still following us about on his camera, on his phone. He's got all this remote camera system. Did you know he's got triggers all around the lake? So even if you go to the toilet at night or whatever, he's got sensors all around both lakes, which trigger his cameras to switch on as soon as you walk past them. There's a ridiculous, I mean, there could be as many as 10, 20 cameras around that lake. You're being spied on constantly, but I've never felt that bad before. I know he's got cameras, and I've seen him. I've never felt that intruded upon before, but because he was on our case, because he wanted to make sure his fish were left alone, and he probably knew deep down he'd put unreasonable restrictions in, so, you know, there is the possibility of somebody taking the piss. He was on the case 24 hours a day. He was watching us on the camera, and I felt it, and I've been there twice before and never felt that, but I really felt it. It was just, we didn't want to be there, you know. All of us were saying, but by Monday, Tuesday, we're just like, I don't care if we lose the money, let's just get out of here. As it turned out, Reedy ended up catching two really big fish, the 69 and then the big one at 90, and that kind of like, for him, it's still a mint trip, because you can't pay for that type of a session, like, even with everything else. And, like, you know, and that was his argument at the end. Well, you had a good trip, didn't you? You caught the scar. I was like, so if we blanked, would we have got our money back? No, of course. I was like, well, the result is irrelevant. The fact is, we didn't get what we paid for. And you know, he threatened to break my legs during the trip because he thought we were taking the piss when we weren't, because of something he thought he saw on the cameras. It was a horrible, horrible experience. And I'm glad you think the same as me in the fact that, all right, put it down to a bad experience. If you had a bad experience in a restaurant or in the B&B or on a holiday with any tour company, you get compensated. It's as simple as that. I just wanted a grand off. I wanted him to do something, say, yeah, you can have a trip next year. Sorry about this, lads. Or, you know, knock €1,000 off. None of that. Not interested in the slice. He wants his cake and eat it. He doesn't want you to catch his fish. He wants them to last forever or as long as they possibly can. He doesn't want to lose any money during the process of that. And the only person that suffers is his customers.
What will happen is the customers will vote, won't they? And they'll vote with their feet. And, you know, you can turn around and go, well, actually, there's always more customers that will want to go and have a go there. And actually, if that's the case, then if you can make the informed choice as to what you want to do, good luck, you know, crack on.
That's why I'm throwing him under the bus here, because I want to make sure people do know, because it isn't a pleasurable experience. And the messages I've had in the last month since that podcast went out, you know, from people having similar experiences all year round, you know, if he decides one week there's a group of fish up there, well, maybe he's got a fish that ain't that well, and, you know, he'll just shut that part of the lake off. Or, like I say, he doesn't want you casting out. You know, a lad cast at a showing fish 20 yards out and got a bollocking for it because he hit the fish with a lead. I mean, that's unreasonable. That's not, you know, that's not a guy that's just got good fish care. That's a guy that's paranoid.
The thing is, as any business knows, you know, you make your bed, you have to lie in it. That's it. I'll just come back to what I said a while ago. I just think that if you're offering something and people are paying good money for it, whatever it is, you should provide it. And if you don't, then you should either let the customer know beforehand that that's not the case, or alternatively, there needs to be some other contingency. And it's, you know, it's as simple as that. It's a fundamental business. It doesn't matter whether you're providing something for sale, a service, a holiday, whatever it is. It's just good manners, good custom care, to do otherwise is wrong. But look, let's not waste any more time talking about it.
No, public awareness, that was all I was trying to do, and I'm glad you know, you gave us a slightly legal perspective of it, because it, just a quick one. I mean,
you're going on again now.
Sorry, just a quick one. This is the thing where I think he feels like he's protected, is he's in France, we're in England. Let's say I did feel completely robbed off and I wanted to get my money back through the legal path. What can you do against somebody that's in a different country?
Well, you can take proceedings against them anyway. You can sue them through French law. The other thing is that, I don't know, does he advertise in the UK? I can't remember.
He doesn't really advertise at all anymore. His website's not been updated for 5 years. I think.
We had an interesting one actually with Ryanair a few years ago where I'd gone out to watch the Swedish rally. And the Swedish rally, we flew over Ryanair because we had to get to Vasteras Airport near Stockholm, and gone out to the WRC, seen it, great event, got back to the airport, and Ryanair have just gone, sorry, we've cancelled the flight. So there was no flight home.
Yeah.
And they just dumped us. We'd let the hire car go, so it was a case of dropping off at the airport, staying there. And Sweden in the winter is cold.
Yeah.
The airport was shutting overnight, and we had nowhere to go. So, you know, it was a little, not hairy, but it was a major inconvenience. And I got back and had a word with Ryanair afterwards and went, you know, come on, this is wrong. And they went, don't care what you say, sue us. I'm like, right, okay. Then they turned around and sort of went, ha-ha, we don't trade out of the UK. We trade out of Ireland, you'll have to sue us under Irish law, expecting that because they traded outside the UK, most people wouldn't do anything and wouldn't take proceedings against them, because obviously for an Englishman to do something through Irish law is difficult, in the same way as it's tricky through French law. But actually, there's no reason why you can't report to French trading standards. There's no reason why you can't report to English trading standards. There's no reason why you can't take proceedings through England if they have a trading desk in England. So our argument with Ryanair, and the reason the point we make is this one. We said, well, you might not trade in England, i.e. the contract was made over the internet and your base is in Ireland. But the reality of it is that you trade in England because you're accepting people's payments in England. If they're paying excess baggage, you have a trading post, so we'll just serve you there instead. Anyway, they backed down on it straight away and compensated us. On the basis that we were going to argue that they did trade out of England.
Right.
And I think there's an argument with that with French fisheries, that if they're taking or making adverts in England, and they're taking payments in England, or you've got a good argument that you could discuss it through either trading standards in the UK, or alternatively through trading standards overseas with France. You know, and the thing is, I'll make it clear now that I'm not aiming this at Luke and his operation, or indeed any individual organisation out there. But there are a number of organisations in France that aren't trading legally.
Yeah.
And they don't have a serie number. They're not registered as a business in France. And also, a lot of it will be cash in hand. Now, if you want to play silly buggers with me, my friend, and if anybody's listening to this thinking that I'm talking to them, I probably am. So it's up to you. If the cap fits, you wear it. If anybody wants to play silly buggers, it's very easy for me to make your life difficult. Very easy indeed. And that would be a quick discussion with the French revenues, just to talk about the amount of cash that turns up at your venue, and we'll find out whether or not that's declared. So we'll leave it at that.
That's
and we'll
enough.
Move forwards.
That's enough. That's enough to be said, because I can think of I'm not going to name specifics, but things that are quite close to my heart where that is exactly the case.
Although, like I say, there's a number of people that will think, "Oh, is that raised at me?" If the cap fits, there we go. Let's leave it there and move forward.
Yeah, yeah. But people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, I think, is the cliche.
Mm.
But yes, moving on, what else have we got? The England team?
Oh, yes. Yes, this is the big one at the moment. It seems to have seems to be dominating my life at the moment. We've had a really good run this year. I can't believe that it's nearly 12 months since the last World Championships. We head out on... Well, the event is the 21st until the 24th of September. So I don't know when you go out. Possibly you'll go out on Saturday the 10th, as in to broadcast. So 2 weeks later, we will be heading, into the last night of the World Championships. I've named the team now.
Yeah.
We're in good shape. We've been out and we've had, obviously, the Six Nations event over there that we won, which was good. And then we've been out for two other practices, so we're in quite good shape. We found a few tactics out. The lake is a very interesting one. It's a place called Lac de Bourdon, and it is about 400 acres in size, and it's split. It's got a dam wall at the one end, which is quite deep. It's shallow at the other end, but it's got another dam wall at the other end where it's been partitioned off into two smaller lakes, one of them being an out-and-out night fishing lake, it's got a reasonable number of carp and you can night fish. And the other one, which we call the middle lake, which has a campsite by the side of it, it's got a beach on it and a bar and ice creams and all of the other bits and bobs. And that's the bit that there's part of it you can fish, but part of it that people go and swim and sort of surf and, you know, sail and do all those activities on as well. So it's a very, very interesting proposition, because technically it's actually three different lakes, but the bigger part of the lake, tactics wise, is probably two different lakes anyway. So there's loads and loads and loads of options that we have to be looking at, depending on where we draw and how we're going to fish it. So it's not just a case of, like in the Ebro, we knew we were turning up and fishing pellet. There's no problem with that. We knew that was what we were going to do, because that works all the way along the whole length of the Ebro, and it just depends on your individual peg as to how you fish that peg. This is like fishing four different lakes, but we might not be on one of them.
Yeah. So
we've got to go geared up for different styles and tactics without even knowing that we're going to be using them.
Well, that to me is the skill in match fishing, you know, is being adaptable when you're there, being prepared for everything. So who are the guys that you're taking? Who is the team?
Mark Bartlett is the captain, and he will be fishing with Harry Charrington. I've got Tom Maker, and he will be fishing with Kev Hewitt. And then we've got Billy Flowers and Jamie Launders. They're the, I suppose, an anchor pair. They're the old lags now. I think this is their 10th World Championship, so they've been around a fair old time. They're the three pairs that will start on the rods. Now, we have a squad of 13 in total. So our substitutes are Wayne Mansford and Ryan Need. And then we have three bank runners, stroke assistants, stroke spotters, and that's Neil Rivers, Chris Holmes, and Carl Pitcher. And then the management squad is myself and Graham Mabey. So there's 13 of us in the team in total. Everybody talks about, oh, it's the rod squad that, you know, the important ones. But in this circumstance, actually, it really is a team. And everybody would like to be Ronaldo, and everybody would like to be the one that's scoring the goals. But actually, you know, it can be the goalkeeper that saves the match, or alternatively, it's a great amount of play in midfield that saves the match as well. So information being fed around the competition will be vitally important. Being able to keep an eye on what the other teams are doing will be vitally important.
Very.
And, you know, I've used this analogy, I think, in the past, where in Spain we had to play a Real Madrid game. And the Real Madrid game was, we just want to go out and score as many goals as possible. And what we're going to do is we're just going to try and score more than you, which is effectively what we did. But that isn't always the best way to attack a game. And this game in particular is going to be slightly different. This game is going to be more, and I'll use Arsenal as a prime example, that you play a sort of slightly slower game and then you try and beat them on the break. And there's a lot more tactics involved in this than just an out-and-out sprint, which the last one was. 72-hour matches, very, very, very different to 48-hour matches. Bait application's different. You know, we are great 48-hour anglers. Great 48-hour anglers. English. And I'll put the Welsh into that as well, because Wales have got a squad in this year too. And what we're used to doing is used to fishing 48-hour matches. We're not used to fishing 72-hour matches. And you might think, oh, it's just the same but 24 hours longer. The reality of it is they are very, very different competitions. And it's almost like the difference between a half marathon and a marathon. That extra 13 miles makes a massive difference.
Yeah. Well, we wish you every success. The whole country will be rooting for you, because it's going to be documented. Facebook Live will hopefully get you on mid-match, if we can get 5 minutes of your time to give us an update each morning.
That
would be great. And
I can't guarantee I'll have any fingernails or hair left by then. I was looking at some pictures actually of last year's event, and people said, what is it like, you know, what's it like running the England team, what's it like being at the World Championships? And the best way I could describe it was showing the picture of a fresh-faced Hughes who's just trotted up to the Ebro, doing a little video snippet saying, here we are, we've arrived, we're all excited. And then, if you remember last year, I had a bit of a disaster in the van on the way back.
Yeah.
And the last picture is of me sat in the back of the van with my face hanging off, having not slept for nearly 4 days, saying, wow, this is a strange end to the tournament. And if you compare those two photographs with each other, That's what it's like. It's the most physically exhausting, emotionally draining, worrying, exciting, horrible, fantastic occasion that you can have. And any dads out there that have been in the delivery room at childbirth, you know how helpless you are and how terrifying it is. This is a sort of close second.
Yeah,
a very close second. So obviously, it's not a life and death situation like childbirth, but it's a very, very hairy experience, I can assure you. But at the same time, it's amazing, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
Well, we wish you every success. We know we're going to regain the crown. It's going to be through hard work, stress, but I've every confidence in you, and I'm sure the whole of the UK fishing community is going to be behind it. So until you're on the bank, I'm going to say goodbye.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, and I'll speak to you soon. Cheers, Jay.
Hughes News.
So a big thank you to Rob. You'll be glad to know I did take him to task over the match fishing, but as ever, Rob's the top guy. He's extremely logical, and you can make your own mind up of that. But I think the match scene does need to look at itself. As Rob rightly pointed out, the carp scene had a bad rep, you know, quite a few years ago. Now there's a few old stuck in the muds that don't like the carp scene now, but I think it's got a lot better PR image than it used to, and I think the match scene needs to do that at the minute. These overstock puddles are they're not good for anyone. They're not good for the anti-angling brigade witnessing it. It makes me uncomfortable, these fish being being treated as they are. It's not good for anything, and you know, overstocked lakes get disease. It's one of those things, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I had my rant last week. I'm not going to say too much more now. I've not listened to what Rob has to say, which I will do as soon as this is uploaded to iTunes and everywhere else. But I did have a couple of interesting chats with people in the tackle shop today. One of the regulars, he comes in every Sunday for his 3 pints of reds, you know, a chap called Wayne. He's in the fish trade, you know, the ornamental, so he knows all about KHV and the rules and laws and regulations of fish movements. And we had an interesting chat about net dips, which are installed everywhere. In his words,
work, basically,
yeah. In his words, you may as well piss on your net, because that's more useful.
Yeah,
he says for these net dips to work, there need to be something a lot stronger than what is used. He says basically so strong you need gloves to handle it. It needs to be in there for half an hour and then dried out.
He says, yeah, best way.
Drying your nets out in UV light is pretty much. It's so simple, but. Do you know what a stink bag is?
No.
It's a great big, like an EVA or PVC bag, which matchmen put the landing nets in. And it's the name stink bag. Well, keep nets, sorry. And it's basically, it's waterproof. It's so you don't get, you know, stinky net slime and water all over the back of your car or van.
Yeah.
You can imagine, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of dry the nets out and are conscious of this, but these stink bags, you can leave your, you know, 2 or 3 keep nets in there and just pull them out in a different fishery the week after. This is how diseases get spread.
It is, yeah. Talking of KHV, there was, what's the department that have been...
DEFRA.
They've been sharing the KHV outbreaks on Facebook. There's an actual page now. Anyway, they shared one for Cromwell Lake in Cambridgeshire. A lot of people tagged me in it and presumed it was the Cromwell Lake that we fish in Newark, which I'd like to state it isn't. Helen's made a statement saying it isn't. It's a different lake. It's a small matchy type lake in Cambridgeshire and Cromwell in Newark, home of the 30s and 40s, they actually provide nets, mats, slings for that very reason. They have done for a couple of years now. You know, you don't need your net, mat or sling to prevent this exact situation. So I was, when I got tagged in it at first, I thought, oh well, what a shame, how's that got in. And I thought about it, I thought it can't be, because they provide all the mats, nets and slings, so I just can't understand how it would have got in there. But it hasn't, and it hasn't got into Cromwell Lake, our Cromwell Lake that we fish. it hasn't got in there. Everything is healthy as far as we are aware. And like I say, they do provide nets, mats and slings for that exact reason, and have done for a couple of years. So I just want to clear that up. We don't need to talk much on this one, Mark. We have we're well over an hour in, hour and a half in already, and I had an hour with one of the members of the A-list of carp fishing royalty, former world British record holder, thoroughly interesting chap. Welcome, Mr. Lee Jackson. So I'd like to welcome some carp fishing royalty to the podcast once again. Hello, Lee Jackson. How you doing, pal?
Yeah, how you doing, mate? Oh, yeah, fine.
Good. We spoke briefly the other day where we got the Carpcast extra content, but this one's just a bit more general. Find out a bit more about yourself for our listeners. So, I mean, I saw a picture on your Facebook the other day that was of a carp from the year I was born. So it was there was a picture. There was a picture in 1972. It was. Forget which fish it was now. I think you put it up in those 10 for 10 pictures.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't think the picture had a name at the time, but as they didn't, you know, there weren't many carp who had names there back then. And but none of it was. I actually started carp fishing in 1970, and I say started carp fishing in 1970, I started really with one rod fishing for carp, sticking it out and then it fish for itself and hoping to catch one, and I continued to float fish with another rod, and consequently in 1970 I caught no carp whatsoever. I think I lost a couple, but, you know, for real experience and what have you. But, you know, still fishing the same lakes I used to float fish on. I put them Lake Dartford and Alton Kirby. And then, you know, progressed to carp fishing with one rod. But then in 1971, I decided to take it a little bit more serious. So, I mean, got my mum to buy me another carp rod. I had a Devonport and Fulham fast strike carp rod, like the standard version. In them days, there was... there was no test curves on rods and everything. There was, my first rod was the standard version. There's a copy of the actual the old Jerry Savage rod, you know, made by Davenport and Fulham, except the Jerry Savage rod was green and the fast strike one was like a funny colour blank. And Mitchell 324 reel. And in 1971, I got my mum to... you know, send away to Bennett's, you know, via the Bennett's and Sheffield catalogue for the stepped up version, which I think in all probability it was probably around about 2¾ pound, another Mitchell 324 reel, because everything had to be matching like it does, you know. I mean, I think that's part of the attraction of the carp fishing. It all looks very smart, doesn't it? You know, I think that's why some of the youngsters of today get attracted to it, you know, not necessarily the actual... Well, I suppose it is the size of the fish as well, but yeah, the attraction of it all looks very smart on the rod press, you know, especially looking at modern day tackle. And 1971 was me first, you know, me start me carp fishing with proper, you know, proper carp fishing, if you like, with two rods and, you know, the float fishing rod put aside, you know. And in the summer of, you know, in the summer of that, funny enough, and I always smile a little bit now because in them days, you know, all my fishing, I started off the day with one with rod fished on the surface on, you know, anchored up floating crust, and the other rod on the bottom, and 9 times out of 10 it used to progress to end up fishing two rods on the surface.
Wow. You know? Which is zigs, like everybody's fishing now.
Yeah, so I smile when they, you know, they talk about zig rigs, because we were doing that back then, you know, albeit it didn't have the name zig rig, you know, and a lot of the time you were fishing under the surface as well, because, you know, because coots and ducks could be troublesome at times, you know, so you put it down so they couldn't see it, you know, and you always knew when your crust had come off, because you know, your bobbiners, which was then squeezy bottle, you know, washing up if you bottle top, so it dropped down, you know. Anyway, next summer, I landed about 7 or 8 carp, I think, and the biggest one was around about £7, £8, something like that. And then that winter, I lived in Deptford in South East London, but I had two mates who lived in the Dartford area. And one of them, we was all school, still at school, and one of them, Brian Fulcher, he said, it's hard. At the time, like in the angling press, there was carp being caught on chemically based baits, didn't have a clue what they were, and people like Derek Stritton were putting catches in the paper and whatever, and my mate Brian, he said, so I found out what they put in these chemically based baits, they put calcium phosphate in it. So the next day at school I asked the chemistry teacher, who was quite helpful as it happens, and I said, what can I put in my fishing bait in the way of calcium phosphate? And my little Jack Russell's just going mad or something. And he said, we go along to the florist, he said, and buy yourself a bag of bone meal fertiliser. He said, make sure you get the sterilised one. He said, it's not sterilised, it can cause a few problems, so off I toodled down to the florist and bought a bag of bone meal fertiliser, which is basically a bag of white stones. And I thought, how can I make this into a bait? So the only way I could think of doing it, but bear in mind there was no such thing as a boilie back then, and you didn't boil baits, all the baits you used was paste baits, and I spent all afternoon in the chemistry lab at school, I was grinding these stones up into a powder with a mortise and pestle, and the only way I could think of making it in bait is make a real sloppy bread paste up and then keep adding this powder, this whitey grey powder to the bread until it made quite a nice paste. And anyway, went fishing, made some up, and the very next day went me and a couple of mates went fishing to Alton Kirby and in Kent, and I still remember that day like it was yesterday. It was really, really sort of almost gale force winds, and I was sitting under my little umbrella and having to hold onto the brolly pole, stop the brolly blowing away, and all of a sudden I had a bite and bought one of my rods, and after quite a sort of long fight, there it was, 24.5 pounds, or 24¾ pounds, I can't remember, one of the two, which actually blew me away, because at the time that was it was 1972, so 24.5 pounds was a big fish back then, and it was February, like winter time. I always remember that I put it in the Angler's Times, and I really did think, I'd arrived, and I think I said in the interview, I actually applied for the BCSG on the strength of that, but realised when I got the forms back, I weren't quite ready. But also, I also thought this bait's something special, but to be perfectly honest with you, I never ever caught another carp on it. Not as it was. I did catch a few. It wasn't long after this that PYM, like Philip Sheep, the East Picture, which was the original, like Fred, the attraction in the original Fred Wilton bait. When that came about, I did try the bait again with some Phillips yeast mixture sort of put into it, and I did catch some carp on that, but more importantly, prior to this I've been making paste baits out of cat food and cat food, kitty cat and sausage meat and stuff like that, and so I'd quite be interested in bait even in them days. And there was a certain sort of satisfaction. You couldn't buy ready-made boilies, obviously, and couldn't buy ready-made base mixes. weren't such thing. So everything you use as bait, unless it was like a tin of luncheon meat, you had to make it up yourself.
I remember those days.
and
bread and breadcrumb usually for me.
Yeah, I used to use a ground bait called Pomintec. Kitty cat and pom and teg, or occasionally I use another ground bait which is like a pinky reddy colour called Kestrel, and consequently the bait used to come out a little bit reddish. that sort of spurred me interest in bait, really, you know. And you know, as you probably possibly remember, like back in them days, well, you wouldn't remember if it was a baby, but you know, in them days you had to make everything. You had to, you know, you didn't know. I mean, the rigs I was using back then was like a link ledger rig, where you had your lead, you know, your small lead, normally about 3/4 ounce on a link, and like a long link as well. And that's how we fish, basically. We look inside the bait, so every time we had a bite, you had to run back about 6 or 7 times just to get it up through the bait.
Yes. And, I remember those days of, I mean, it was 79 when I started fishing, 79, 80, yeah. And I was fishing for carp by sort of 81, 82, same as you, one rod, you know, still on the float, and the other rod ledger in on luncheon meat or something. But a lot of people won't remember, when you're fishing pace baits or fishing, you know, threading a size 12 hook through the luncheon meat and holding it with a bit of grass on the back, I mean, you had to strike, didn't you, to, you know, just because you got a screamer did not mean you were hooking that fish.
No, it didn't. I can remember one occasion, funny enough, when I read a Jim Gibbons article in the Angling Papers, and he'd made some beef burger boilies.
Right.
And so I made these beef burger boilies up, and because they're still a bit soft, I rolled them into balls, you know, paste bait sized balls, and took them to the lake frozen in a thermos flask, and you know, free line one of these out there, the first cast, I free line one of these out there, and had a bite, and I played this carp all the way to the edge, and then his head came out of the water, and its mouth opened, and the bait pops out of his, out of his mouth. I haven't even looked at it. You know, the bait was still frozen.
Just had its mouth
shut. And the only reason I played it in, because it had his mouth closed.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, it was all fun. I mean, the main thing is, it was very exciting. You know, very exciting. You didn't really catch what you catch, you know, care what you caught, provided you caught something, and like the bigger the better, really, you know. And and there's carp were the biggest fish in the lakes back then, and you know, and you know, but there's no catfish about apart from places like Wheelstone Reservoir and places like that in Bedfordshire. You know, it really was exciting. But one thing I do remember, you never ever went fishing without some sort of bite, you know, indication. Yeah. You know, you never went fishing without having a bite of some sort.
Yeah.
And there was always something going on, and, you know, in Kent area, obviously, we went through the twitter routine stage where, I used to sit there and, you know, providing it wasn't too windy, and sit there and watch me lines where they entered the water and just watch, you know. And as soon as you cast out, there's always the line was kicking out, and, you know, little knots on it and everything. And
I suspect that in the days when you had to watch your bobbin as well, you're glad there was no alarms really very early on.
There was alarms, but as I think I said in the question, I used to think, like, if you had air and bite alarms and you put the line around the antenna, then it offered too much resistance, you know, which is obviously it's quite the reverse of what you want to actually achieve, really, because you wanted more resistance, as we found out in latter years. But no, it was good fun, and I used to watch the line, and you know, if the line started twitching, I'd wind the bottle top. We're always in Kent, you know, traditionally we fished our rod sort of waist high as well, and used to stand by the rod and wind the bottle top up near the butt, and just watch the line. If the line flicked forward and held forward, then you'd strike, and often there was a carp on the end.
So you're hitting twitches even back then, which is probably the equivalent of like single beeps and stuff now.
It is, yeah. I mean, because you like bobbins as well, you're always, you know, you're always getting some form of indication, whereas nowadays, you know, you don't tend to get so much of that, you know.
I mean, you obviously were fishing in those days when there was no purpose-made carp tackle, and you work in the tackle box, which is, you know, one of the biggest and best tackle shops in the country. You must have seen the evolution of fishing gear, you know, firsthand. I mean, does it blow you away now that the fact that everything's so comfortable? If there's a new technique, I mean, somebody's made a product for it the following year, you know, like Zigger liners or whatever. As soon as it breaks,
and you've got a tag for a bag and things like that, and you know, it blows me away. But in many ways, I think people are missing out. They've missed out on that period where you had to make things and improvise and what have you. And it's just so sort of stereotyped, the fishing nowadays, for a lot of people. You know, they have to use a pair of some distance sticks and things like that, and they've got to have a spot rod, and they've got to have a marker rod, and they've got to have this to go with it here, which is good for the tackle trade, but you know, a lot of times it's not very, not that necessary. But if that's what, and the other thing that gets me is how people, that's that their body stops the same colour as their bait, and things like that, and all these plastic baits are about, all these imitation baits. Do people really think a carp swims around the lake, bottom of the lake, and thinks, "Oh, that looks like a bit of sweet corn, I'll eat that"? Of course they don't. You might as well just cut a bit off your flip flop and put that on an air rig, and you still catch carp.
As has been done. There are no people that have caught fish on flip flops,
but I guess
you had to be more creative then, because it wasn't put in front of you. There was hardly any material. There was no internet. You couldn't just go, "Oh, so-and-so's catching a load of fish doing this," unless you were plugged into the grapevine, which sounds like you probably were down there, but for most people they weren't. You try a kitty cat paste one day, you try something different the next day, and you'd keep trying until you found a way that got more action or more activity. Whereas now you go out and buy whatever brand of boiler you're using. All right, I'm using Activate this year, I'm using Scopex Squid or whatever it is. You buy it, and you probably don't even think about changing the colour. Or, I used to dye my, we used to use munchies, like the cat biscuits for floaters, thread six or seven of them up the line after pouring boiling water on them. The dog biscuits, used to try different food colourings in them, anything that was in the cupboard, and I got a red ones one day, and it was kind of like you'd do something different every single time you went fishing.
Like making my own bait, and I used to use, meticulously weigh the ingredients out, half ounce of this or quarter ounce of this, and make up a 10 ounce mix. It was always 10 ounce mixes. I think they come about because it enables you to easily work out the protein content of the bait. 6 eggs went in a 10 ounce mix normally, and roll them in the balls, and I always used to count them. In them days, because the baits were considerably bigger than what they are nowadays, you always used to count how many boilies you had got in a 10 ounce mix,
Did you always used to, like, when you made a mix, a boilie mix up yourself, you'd end up with like one big one at the end of it or something when you'd, did you ever catch on that big one?
Yes, I did, I mean, sometimes, if you was, especially if I was getting bream activity, and I'd perhaps put the big one on, and quite often I caught a carp on it, But the strange thing is, you don't learn from it. You get one on a big, great big bait at the end, why not make them all big,
Yeah.
But you do the same next time, you roll them all a certain size, and they was all ambry rolled in as well, weren't they,
That's all
good stuff, like a great big sort of learning curve, where nowadays it's very simple for people to go carp fishing, and catch carp, because there's a lot more waters with them, a lot more waters with bigger fish,
I guess they weren't purposely stocked back then. They were kind of just as well as everything else, weren't they? I mean, nowadays, clubs and syndicates will go out and buy X amount of fish. I'm guessing you just kind of had to find where the carp were in those days.
We were quite lucky in Kent because of the Kent River Bowl stockings in the 1960s, 70s and that. Most of the lakes in Kent had carp in them. Whereas if you lived up north or something, that's a drive miles to find a lake with carp. So I think we were very fortunate in that score because, really Kent was the odd better carp fishing at the time. And there was a lot of, anglers who became well-known, household names and everything, that started their carp fishing in Kent, even though they lived in Lincolnshire or Misham in Surrey and places like that,
Thank the Lord for the Kent River Board.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you go back to Jack Hilton's book, Quest for Carp, which I think is one of the best carp books ever written, there was reference in there to in the like 1960s, 1966, and things like that, fishing a lake called Goodwood Lakes, and Goodwood Lakes is actually Footman's Lake, Dartford, and they was probably the people when I used to go down there float fishing, you know, when I was a youngster, who I saw with the floppy hats and that, and who wouldn't talk to you. You know, kept all very secretive. But then, you know, so those people, like Jack Hilton, had travelled from Hertfordshire or whatever to fish at a lake in Dartford on the strength of seeing a fishing the angling times, what Jerry Savage has called, £26, you know? So I think Kent was a little bit... There was obviously other lakes throughout the country that had a few stockings of a few carp, but not as... You know, they weren't as prolific in other parts of the country as they were in Kent, I don't think.
One of the lakes I associate you with from that area, from Kent, was the school pool. Yeah. How did you come about finding that place and getting on and stuff?
Well, I always knew about a school pool and Faversham, and because, to be honest, you know, there wasn't many lakes about. I mean, the first lake I ever fished, albeit I didn't get to fish it much because that was the year that was 1982. That was the first lake I'd ever fished with two definite, not talking about the school pool now, I'm talking about Ashley Pool.
Yeah.
The Ashley Pool was the first ever lake I fished that definitely contained two carp over 30 pounds. There was Lucky and Umpy. And I managed to get in the Ashley Syndicate, but to be honest with you, because that was, you know, because of the distance from home, and that was a year where my wife had her first baby, and she was born in 1982, and she had a lot of ongoing problems. She had to go in and out of hospital quite a few times. I only got to fish it twice, never caught anything. So in Kent, and to be honest with you, how it come about fishing the school, I mean, I knew about the school pool. I fished it on a BCSG fishing weekend, never caught anything, but from memory, I think she was actually caught that weekend. And then, you know, the old mate Alan Smith, who unfortunately died of cancer, God rest his soul, we both had a week off work each at the end of one season, you know, when it was a close season, and we decided to go, you know, somewhere different. You know, we both had good seasons fishing the waters we'd been fishing, so originally we were going to go to Walthamstow Reservoirs, but when we checked up, the Water Authority workers had gone on strike, so that was out the window. So I said to Alan, well, this is when Kevin Maddox had first started fishing the same season as Kevin Maddox started fishing the school pool, obviously with the air rig, and, you know, I mean, the fish on the front cover of Carl Fever's sheet, and he had some real good catches. So I said to Alan, well, yeah, why don't we go down to the school pool? So we did. We went down there just for a day, you know, and I can always remember this. I remember this as plain as day. I run Kevin, because Kevin used to come down and fish down where I was fishing at the time. I mean, Kevin, he was mechanically one of the best anglers I've ever seen. But a lot of his fish location was done on the telephone. Right. You know, he'd ring up me and say, how's it going on Darrenp and all that, and I'd tell him everything. You know, I never ever kept any secrets from him, and he had people planted all around the country where he could, you know, ask these, you know, ring up and see how it's going, like you do, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, nothing really wrong in it. And I rang Kevin on the Sunday evening, and I said, you know, we're going to go down to the school pool tomorrow. Any little pointers, you know? And to be honest with you, he never gave us anything to go by whatsoever. So we turned up there on the Monday morning, and you know, just fishing on the day ticket. And I naturally thought, like, Kevin was, you know, by this time I was well adept at long range fishing. I naturally thought Kevin caught his fish out in the middle. The lake, which is about 90-100 yard cast, and so that's where I was fishing, and Alan in the swim next door. And around about midday, I saw a fish jump out, probably only about 30 yards out. So, like, I reeled a rod in and cast to that and caught one. And I caught I caught two and lost one, and Alan lost two. And then we packed up, you know, sort of very early evening, went home and went back the next day. So this time we went back for the next day and fishing the same two swims, and we had action straight away, and I think I caught another two fish, and Alan caught two 20-pounders, and I think Alan lost one as well. So we had between us, we had six fish in a couple of days, and when I got home that evening, Kevin Maddox rang me, and he said, "How did you get on?" And I told him, and he said, "Where was you fishing?" And I said, "To be honest with Kev, I said, I don't feel very obliged to tell you, because, you know, you didn't give me any pointers when I asked you on Sunday." I said, "So, plus the fact we're going to go down there just for a morning. We can only do the morning tomorrow, so we'd like to get in the same swims." And he turned a bit shirty on the phone. And when we got down there, there he was. Kevin was in the... Alan was actually absolutely disgusted. He didn't say anything at all. He just wandered off. And there was Kevin and his friends, you know, fishing the swims we'd fished, you know. So yeah. He'd obviously got straight off the phone from me and then rung around to find out where we were fishing. But the thing is, what didn't bother us was that we had all the action in the morning. We had a little feeling that the fish had moved in the afternoon, and I could always remember Kevin sitting in his chair with it, and when the first walks along to him, he said, "So where were you fishing?" I said, "You know full well where we were fishing," and he had a real smirk on his face, you know. And as I walked away, I said, "Still, we're not really worried because the fish have moved anyway." That's only a guess, you know. And I looked round his face again, and it drops. And we went round on the factory bank. Alan caught a 29-pounder, the old lever in the school pool, and I had another two fish. And you know, so we was from the factory bank.
Yeah.
And then I went back just for an afternoon the next day. You know, then Kevin moved round. He had his tackle ready to move in as soon as we moved out. And I went back for an afternoon the next day, caught a couple more fish. Actually, I caught three the next day from a swim called The Point. And then went home, and we fished the last day of the season on the Saturday. And Kevin by now was in The Point swim where I'd caught the three. I think Alan managed to catch a 25-pounder on the... Alan caught four fish, actually, and I caught something like... I think I actually caught 13 fish, you know, in those short sessions. But Alan, my biggest one was, I think, about 18-pound. But Alan had four fish, but that was all 20s.
Wow.
But I did smile when the story came out in Carp Fever. It wasn't quite written like that by Kevin. You know, I wonder why, you know. But anyway, obviously, it's a good lake, and we, in them days, it had a bit of a radius on the lake. You had to live in the Faversham area, which we didn't. And but someone said to us, if you go around, the old club secretary, a guy called Tony Baldock, he lived in a caravan on another nearby Faversham club lake, Bisingwood, and... So if you go down and see Tony, you can give him the money, you can get in the club. So we did, you know. So in other words, we got him through the back door, you know, bypass any waiting lists. But the attraction with that was she, really, again, fishing a lake with a 30-pounder in it, you know. And the leather, obviously, which went over 30 pounds as well on occasions.
How did it get its name, She? Who named it, or where did that come from?
Andy Spreadbury wrote a chapter, a real long chapter in the BCSG magazine, The Carp. Yeah. And he actually entitled the article She. And I think it was written in around about 1974, 76, something like that. But Andy was down there with his mate Pete Anley. And Pete Anley caught this fish. I think it was about 30.5 pounds, something like 30.25 pounds. I can still remember the picture in the angling papers, and which was a massive fish for the time. And like Andy, like me, got obsessed with catching that fish. You know, and I still I think at the time, I think that was one of the best articles ever written, because Andy's ever such a good writer, and the emotion showed through and everything.
Was that your first 30 pounder then, she?
No, it wasn't. No, I actually caught her in 19. I think I mentioned this the other day, when I've done the question bit. In 1983, I was fishing for a fishy in Essex, which I mentioned, which was around about £38, and then the club lost the fishing rights. So then I joined Arrow, what became known as Arrow, called the £40 on the first day of the season, and that was, in effect, I'd caught a with a 24 pounder in 1972, I'd caught a 20 before, I caught a double. on June the 16th, 1983, caught a 40 before I ever caught a 30.
Wow.
But I went on to, I went to, to catch a few more 30 pound fish out of Arrow, and I think I caught a couple out of other places as well. But, I had this obsession with shea, but just couldn't catch it. Again, as I said in the questions the other day, but so it wasn't my first 30 pounder, but it was obviously, like I said, it was one of my most memorable catches.
Yeah, and then you went on to catch it a few more times after that, didn't you?
That's right, yeah, three more times. Four occasions altogether, I caught it,
Right, wow.
A special carp, which unfortunately probably died about 5 or 6 years ago, albeit the body of it wasn't ever found,
Just talking about Harrow, I mean, that's a name that probably most modern carpers won't even be aware of, unless you did a guest chapter in, is it Terry Hearn's book?
I've done one in Tiger Bay, Rob Maiden's book.
Oh, that's right, yeah, I forget
which
books they were, I remember reading a chapter about Harrow. I mean, it's a lake that was extremely tough to get in, wasn't it? There's another one you had to live within a radius.
I don't think there was no radius on it, but it became, because I caught that fish on it had no publicity rule, and because I caught that fish on June 16th, 1983, though I didn't publicise the fish, I think the angling papers ring around the local tackle shops and if you ever heard of anything caught, and so they can have got something to report, on the first day of the season. So it was actually a lot, at the carp grapevines, every man and his dog almost knew I'd caught a 40 pounder, because it was a massive fish then, and pretty soon it went from a club with no waiting list to quite a big waiting list. But it didn't matter where you lived. It's just a case of, a lot of the times it was, there's no such thing as a waiting list, really. You got in. I mean, obviously, I think if I'd have tried to join it again, a few years later, somebody else had caught that 40 pound, and I'd have tried to join it a year or so later, I wouldn't have got in, as would a few people, because the local guys were very protective against their fishing. Initially they didn't like us blokes from Essex or Kent, because they've had it all for all these years to themselves. But it transpired. I mean, it turned into one of the best best waters in the country at the time.
Yeah, it's still with two big ones, isn't it? That were quite well known.
Well, yeah. I mean, when the, I don't actually know. I mean, obviously the 40 pounder that I had that died. They had a bit of a fish kill one year, and that fish was one of the fish that died. There was a fish like Chop Dorsal. Dorsal was the biggest fish in the lake. And then you had Tyson, which is still about nowadays, funny enough. Tyson, there was Demons, and there was quite a few big fish in there, and they really used to stack on the weight. There's no night fishing rule, so days only, and as a result of these, as is normally the case on these day only waters, the best time is first thing in the morning or last thing in the evening when you've got to get off and go home, you know, and especially in the autumn time, I mean, it was possible to go down there and catch. It wasn't easy, you know, by no stretch of the imagination was it an easy lake, but it was, you know, it's where dreams come true, really, because, you know, you could go down there in an evening, and if you was lucky enough, catch 2 30s, you know, which was a big thing then, you know. I mean, I think the only waters that came close to it were nearby waters like, obviously, Savay, and like the Conns and the Fisheries.
I lived in Watford for a few years, and you know, I used to go exploring as close as I could get to those lakes, the Conns and the Fisheries, and I ended up. It became fairly common knowledge what was in the Conns. I never really got to the bottom of the Fisheries. I mean, what? Because that was kept quite secret at the time as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it still is, to be honest with you. I mean, still, you know, a lot of people. I mean, funny enough, I got in the Conns eventually. I waited about, I was about 5 years on the waiting list, and then I suddenly got the, I think you had to get a Troy ticket first or something, yeah. And, you know, before you could, you know, get a chance to go on the, you know, get in the Conns. And I can remember I got in the Conns, went for the, you know, for the vetting and whatever, which I found quite intimidating as it happens, you know, sitting there with sort of being questioned by 9 fellas, you know. I got in it, but I never ever fished it. And I was a member of it for about 4 or 5 years. And I suddenly thought, well, yeah, do you know what? I'm paying this money every year, but I've got no intention of fishing it. But I think on the fisheries, I fished that a couple of times as a guest, you know, over like a Christmas social or something like that, and caught carp out of it. But
really,
but that was, I think that's still fairly hush-hush now. But the thing is, at the time, these lakes were pretty special because they had an abundance of big fish, you know. But now everywhere else is caught up with them, you know.
Yeah, some of those Cone Valley waters, they had the big weights early doors, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because, like I say, fish have caught up everywhere else now. You know, people
that's
have stopped
right, yeah.
faster growing
yeah,
strange.
That's right, yeah. I mean the Conns in particular. I can already remember on the when they had the first year of the Savay Syndicate when Bob Davies ran it. I mean, Bob invited me up there for a guest pot, you know, for a night as a guest, and you know, we sat there chatting. And funny enough, we fished where probably no the current syndicate for the last quite a few years have ever fished. That was on the cottage bank, but right next to the cottage.
Right.
Because that's out of bounds now, but at the time you could fish it on that first year. And, you know, chatting to Bob throughout the evening, and I mean, neither of us caught anything, and he went off in the morning to go and fish the day on the Conns, and I stayed on Savay for the day, and when I rang him when I got home that evening, I rang him, you know, thanked him, you know, for his, you know, this was sort of 1983, I think. Thanks him for, it might have even been before that, it might have even been 82, but whatever, you know, thanks him for taking me and all that, you know, so he really enjoyed it, even though I didn't catch anything, and I said, oh, how did you get on the Bobby? He said, oh, not too bad, he said, I had a couple of 27s, a 25, a 24, 2 23s and all that. I thought, shit, like, you know, they was catching fish out of, like, the Conns, like, it was the sort of equivalent of fishing in Kent for doubles, you know.
Yeah.
All these fish in the Conns and that was well over £20.
What was the Savay experiences like? Did you fish? Did you get the full ticket? And were you on the
route? No, I got offered a ticket the second year of the syndicate. But because of the distance from home, and you know, I was, you know, my work situation, I was a dustman back then, and you know, I didn't really get the opportunity to fish many nights, and I didn't take it up, you know, but I did fish it on a day ticket. I can remember, you know, one session that was sort of, again, that was 1983, I think. Just fished it, you know, done 5 day sessions, sleeping in my car of a night and fishing by day, and managed to catch 2 fish and lost one. But I've got to say, it was the it was one of the best places I've ever fished at the time because of the camaraderie on the bank, you know.
Yeah.
You know, up until then, like, everyone was very secret. You know, if you fished the Kent Lakes, everyone was so very secretive. No one would sort of tell me what bait they was using, or no one, you know, kept sort of quiet what rig they was using. And I mean, myself, I mean, I used to be secret as well. But all of a sudden, you're on this lake and Savvy and everyone's sitting there in each other's swim rolling bait. You know, it's a Savvy anglers against a carp, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a, you know, marvellous atmosphere with obviously a lot of, and a real special lake, you know. It's lots and lots of big fish, lots and lots of 30 pound fish.
And still going strong today as well, isn't it?
Still going, really. I mean, it's gone out of the limelight a little bit, but, you know, Savvy is still, still a, you know, special water, you know, with lots of big fish in it, you know. Yeah. But no, I got a chance to join the syndicate. I never did, you know. Yeah, I think mainly because I was travelling that distance and I was fishing Arrow at the time, and you know, for the hours of my fishing, Arrow was actually a better water than Savvy.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's, I mean, I think it's one of the other reasons I didn't join it.
Yeah. The, so, winding forward a few years, probably I believe the whole country was rooting for you to catch a British record because you documented the entire journey in a series of magazine articles, and that was, yeah, Collingbrook and Two Tone.
Yeah.
It sounds, again, talking about camaraderie on the bank, I think that place, the thing that stuck in my mind from the articles was the barbecues, the socials, the fun, yeah, everybody was having down there. And
that's right, yeah, yeah.
Obviously you went on to catch the fish. I remember reading that, I don't know if it was true, but it came across in the pieces that, you know, you were pulling your hair out at times and you know, trying different, yeah, yeah, things, and you know, you trying like squeezed bread and in PVA bags and stuff. You were trying every, you looked like it was an obsession. You were trying really hard to catch
the fish. I was absolutely obsessed with catching it, and you know, and the, I mean, annoying thing, I mean, it used to get, I mean, the easiest time, as it is on most lakes in the UK, really, the easiest, the most productive time on Collingbrook was probably May, April and May. But Two Tone used to come out 2-3 times a season. And you know, as I said in the thing the other day, I mean, you can cast that in the lake, but you can't pick and choose what picks up your bait.
No.
You know, unless you can see them. And yeah, when it's, you know, I was absolutely obsessed with catching it, but it, you know, as I said, the camaraderie on the bank was next, you know, next to, but the trouble is, I always felt that because it was what I wanted to catch. I mean, all the time I was sitting there by that lake with my rods in the water, there was a buzz because the biggest carp in the country, well, round about the biggest carp in the country, was swimming around in it, If someone else used to catch it, I must admit, it wasn't jealousy. It was probably worse than that.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Pain. I know that pain.
Yeah, the pain. And you think, oh, blimey. Yeah, and, but, you know, because I was quite successful as far as Collingbrook goes. I mean, I caught quite a few fish out of it, but just not that one. And funny enough, when the year I did catch it, which 2002, I actually made a plan before that season started. I analysed everything. You know, I thought, right, hang on. I made up my mind that there were swims I would never, because I'd always fish Collingbrook, the wild fish, everywhere else, to try and catch as many fish as I can.
Yeah.
And hope that big one comes along the way, you know.
Mm.
And but that wasn't really the way. Well, it might have been for some people, but it wasn't the way to catch that fish, because it wasn't in with the crowd, if you know what I mean. You know, if the fish were jumping out of the lake, I'd be fishing that spot, you know, but you bet your life Two Tone wasn't there. But I made my mind up on three things. One, there was three swims I would fish as much as I could. You know, in other words, three swims that had the best track record of producing that fish. The other thing was what I would do. There were swims I definitely wouldn't fish, because I didn't, you know, it never got caught from those swims, and you know, just wouldn't fish them, you know. And I'm also made my mind up on, you know, what would, you know, the best chance of catching it in the spring will be on a yellow pop-up, you know. You know, from one of the swims where it gets caught from. You know, cast that yellow pop-up and hope that, you know, it comes along. And to be honest, in previous years, I've done pretty well on the yellow pop-up thing, and, you know, but I didn't caught two-tone, obviously, but caught quite a few fish. But that was in the springtime. And then come mid-June, yeah, once the natural food really gets old, I wouldn't use boilies at all. You know, I'd use something different. But at that stage, that particular year, I didn't know what I'd use, you know. And I really did struggle in May and June. I, you know, where I'd normally catch half a dozen fish in them months, I caught one, I think, one 17-pounder. And it was like really sort of scratching my head. And it was only really when the bread method came to mind, and that will come about through Leroy Swan, really, my mate Leroy. It was such a tremendous angler, Leroy. And he was, you know, he was going to take his young son on his first ever fishing trip. And, you know, for ground bait, they was using liquidised bread. And immediately when he said that, my mind went back to when I was a kid. You know, I'd never had enough pocket money to buy ground bait. So, but there was always, bread was always plentiful in our house. So I used to make it out of, you know, mashed up bread, and that used to work better than like any ground bait. And but as soon as Leroy said that, it sort of triggered the idea in my head. And I, next to the tackle box then was a dairy, and I went in there, bought a couple of loaves of bread, and ground it up in a food processor, and put it in PVA bags. Compressed it in the PVA bags through one of these bags into the sink, these mesh bags in the sink at work, and I just couldn't believe the reaction. I thought, this has got to work, you know. I mean, Connybrook was perfect for that method in that there was not really much in the way of nuisance. Well, the nuisance fish in there were pike, so if you used anything fish mealy or pellets or stuff like that, you know, you could get trouble with pike. But there's no like roach, and I think it was an anther, a tench maybe, but they never ever, you know, if you had a bite, it was either at normal circumstances. I mean, I don't know if it's always a little bit over recent years, but in normal circumstances, if you had a bite, it was normally a pike or a carp. Yeah. You know, there was no, really, did you ever catch anything else? And yeah, that, I mean, that method worked. I mean, I perfected it. The first time I used it, I just used the bread, like, compressed up. My typical mix for my session was two loaves of old mill bread and one loaf of white bread, all ground up in the food processor and for the PVA bags. And because I used to leave the crust on the bread, it's just cheap King's Mill bread, you know, nothing extravagant on it. It's just a cheap King's loaf of fresh as I could get it, could buy it. And I mean, the first time I used it, I caught the first time was, I was a bit lost as to what to use for a look bait. And the first time I caught an eel, I think I caught the first time I used it. But next time I caught, I add some sweet corn to the bread, and so I've got, you know, a small tin of Green Giant, and dried it all off, put it in with a mix of bread, and also a pint of casters. And the next time I caught a 24-pounder, and that was it. That was gave me the confidence, and I was using maize and a hook bait. And so that was really, I mean, and it progressed. I mean, in the finish, my mix was, you know, the two loaves of wholemeal bread, a loaf of white bread, a few chilli flakes, a pint of casters, a small tin of dried out sweet corn, and occasionally, if I could collect them, a few little snails, what used to, you know, I'd collect from the lake, you know?
Yeah.
And that was it, and as I said in the question, but it was such a good method for that lake. Yeah, and in the end, it wasn't a case of was it going to get a bite, it was which one I was going to catch, you know.
and it obviously, you know, worked. Did you catch it from one of the three swims?
Yes, I did, yeah. Yeah, caught it from the island swim. But funny enough, I didn't, because when you make that, you know, with the bread method, because you're leaving the crust on, initially those PVA bags, you have to, you know, if you throw them in the water, they float initially, then after, you know, after half a minute, they sink. So in order to bait up, I was casting the PVA bags into a, I suppose a 4-inch bag. It was about 4 inches long, I think, the made-up bags, and you know, once PVA dissolved and they exploded, you had at least a 6-foot circumference of, 6-foot diameter of a spread from the bridge, you know?
Hmm.
It used to decorate all the weeds and everything, and you know, the carp used to come in there and just smash it to bits. And, I used to cast the PVA, you know, baiting up with casting the PVA bags into position, so I'd do one rod, you know, one bag, then I do the middle rod, then I do the other rod, then I go back to the first one, reel that in, repeat all. But actually, on the day I caught 2-ton, because I wasn't really, my heart weren't in it, you know, in the fishing, I picked up a rod that I'd already baited up, reeled it in, I thought, oh shit, I've already done that rod, you know, and I couldn't be asked to, you know, bait up again. So all I literally done was cast out a single grain of maize. I knew roughly where I'd cast it anyway, and that was the one I caught 2-ton on.
And you know, caught 2-ton at a British record. You got the certificate, and what a feeling that must have been.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, all I really wanted to do was catch that carp, but it was a very big bonus, you know, catching a British record weight.
You caught the biggest fish in the land and at the biggest weight at the time.
I've got a weight memory on the program of Question of Sport. There was one night I was indoors and the Question of Sport was on, and in, you know, one of the people on it was David Seaman, and one of the questions were who is the British record carp holder, who is the carp British record holder, and David Seaman immediately said it's Lee Jackson. And then my mate came up on their little thing, podium thing, I was sitting behind, and my kids went mad upstairs, Dad, they spent it on the telly, like all that, you know. So it was it was a special, yeah, as I said before, it was a special day when I caught that fish, and very proud to be, you know, I think there's a difference between pride and ego. Very proud to have been lucky enough to have caught a British record.
Yeah, it's a fantastic achievement. And like I say, I'm sure the whole country was willing you on with that, because you're very honest in those articles, you know, about how it was getting to you, and, you know, how obsessed you'd become by that fish. And every month I was reading it, willing you to catch it, you know, and I'm sure everybody else was. We've been nearly an hour now, which is pretty much where we wrap things up. I wanted to talk about the music. I've known you sort of associated with music. Used to play in a little band after some of the carp shows at the socials. Was it Five Lakes? Usually, I've seen pictures of you with a guitar in your hand. I'm a guitarist myself, played for a living for 20 years. So, have you always been in? You know, have you always played music? Do you still play in a band now? Tell us a bit.
No, far from it. I mean, far from it. I used to play. Yeah, you know, when I was a youngster, I used to, you know, play a bit of acoustic guitar, one of concerts, Catford Town Hall, playing acoustic guitar, and then, but when I left my primary school, I completely packed it up, and it wasn't really until, I bought an electric guitar, I think, when I was about 13, and all I was interested in was making, you know, rubbing it up against the amplifier and making funny noises with it, and then it wasn't really until I've always had a little bit of an ear for music, you know, but I don't claim to ever have been good at it. And then Clive Gibbons, he rung me, who plays drums in the band and still does, I think, he rung me and said, well, this was when the carp shows were proper, I think, when the main, you went there to see the main entertainment rather than what it's like nowadays, is a glorified sort of tackle show. And he said, well, I would think of forming a band to play at the Carp Society Conference. I wonder if you'd like to have a go on the bass. I said, blimey, Clive, I said, I've never ever picked up a bass guitar in my life, yeah, but I'd love to have a go. And that was it. We, you know, everyone was sent a Dean cassette tape to learn their bit, and we had, I think, one rehearsal, and then played at Dunstable on stage. And I must admit, by that time, I'd done loads and loads of slideshows around the country. Never ever got nervous, but I was so nervous. You know?
Do you remember what songs you played?
Yeah, it was all sort of like rock stuff, maybe. I mean, like AC/DC stuff, like Thin Lizzy, bit of Bryan Adams. I mean, I think the best one we ever done was Purple Rain, Prince's Purple Rain.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, you know, when we rehearsed that, when we played it, Andy Boulder, who unfortunately died, who was the lead singer and lead guitarist. Yeah, you know, when he played the solo at the end, it just blew me away. I looked at him playing, I thought, how can someone be that good?
Yeah.
You know, it's, it just blew us all away.
We used to finish with that song in our band, you know, 4 or 5 nights a week for years. Yeah, it was one of my favourite all-time songs. And
That's right, yeah. But no, it was like sort of, you know, mainly rock stuff and stuff like that, but really enjoyed it. And as a result of the Dunstable, I mean, I think we played about 3 years at Dunstable, once at Wembley, and there was a couple of offshoot gigs where we done at various things, but it wasn't something that I'd wanted to sort of do. I've still got as we're sitting here, I mean, I'm sitting here looking at a Fender Stratocaster and the bass guitar, you know.
Yeah.
on stands in my living room, you know. But I'll pick them up now and again and, you know, make a little noise with them.
Yeah, mine are ornaments now, as you say. I've got a
I'm sure you can perhaps sort of relate to this. It's sometimes you can just grab the guitar, turn the amp on and just get lost in it a little bit, you know, in your own little world. And yeah. It doesn't matter if you can play it or not, you know, sometimes it's just...
Something satisfying about cranking that amp up and making feedback noises with the guitar. It's a little bit, I don't know what it is, it's a little bit satisfying, isn't it? It just gives you...
That's right. I always remember when we used to go on the stage at Dunstable, and Andy always used to say, don't put the volume up too high, and consequently you get on the stage, and Andy, I mean, if Andy had a number 11 on the volume control, he'd turn it to it, you know.
I'm sure you've seen the film Spinal Tap, haven't you?
No, I haven't seen it, no.
Oh, that's one of the jokes in there. It's a great film, actually. You'd like it if you liked all the rock stuff, but it's a fictional rockumentary about a band on tour, an English heavy metal band that a lot of people believed was true at the time. There was a book and a film. It's really funny, but yeah, that's one of the jokes in it, about he's having this amp done and he's like, I want it to 11, it's got to go to 11.
it was
basically every cliched rock joke you've ever heard of in kind of one film, but made as if it was serious. It's pretty funny.
Brilliant. Yeah,
check it out.
Yeah, but strangely enough, you're having this conversation as well. I mean, Tim Paisley has actually asked us to reform the Carp Society supergroup to play at a conference they're having in Essex at the Circus Tavern in November. And the problem we got is, both people used to sing was Chris Aswell, who used to sing like, you know, sort of Bryan Adams, Rod Stewart-y type stuff, or type voice, and Andy Boulder, who was a lead guitarist, lead singer, and both of them have passed away. You know, so we're struggling a little bit at the moment. We need another guitarist and someone who can sing. You know, Terry Cheeseman, who was in the band, who's, you know, he's a brilliant guitarist, so he's well able to do the, you know, the lead bits and everything like that and sing some of the songs. But there's, so we're basically on the lookout for a rhythm guitarist, if you're interested.
I was always the lead guitar, I was the show off.
Well, I'm sure Terry will let you do a bit of lead as well. Listen,
that's something we can definitely talk about. I'm not a great singer. We always had singers in our band. I can manage a bit of backing vocal, but this is something we can discuss. I've still got all my gear, guitar wise, acoustics, and and lead guitars. I've got three of them.
Brilliant, yeah.
But yeah, there's 35,000 people listen to this show every month. So if any of you are a decent rock singer, then get in touch with Lee.
And the carp angler.
Yeah, it needs to be a fisherman. It's got to be a carp supergroup, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah,
fantastic. I haven't covered loads of your life history because there is tons and tons and tons of it, but we've been an hour now, so I'd like to wrap this up, but I would love to get you back at some point and we'll have another chat, because you are one of the most popular and longest serving anglers today, and thank you very much for talking to us, Lee.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So a big thank you to Lee. It's one of our most requested guests we've ever had. And, he was catching fish in the year I was born, catching big fish too. I mean, that tells you a lot. And he's made me want to go and read A Quest for Carp again, Jack Hilton's book. Still says it's one of his the best ever carp books written. And I quite agree. I read it when I was young. Yeah, there weren't too many books about it. It was Cypri the Carp, Quest for Carp. And then a few years later came the Hutchie books and Maddox books and stuff. But yeah, I'm going to read Quest for Carp again, I feel. I'd say something that I didn't mention last week, shameless self plug. I'm selling my carp wagon, VW Transporter T5, all pimped inside, especially with carp fishing in mind. It's got the top of the range Smev cooker, double burners. It's got the Waco fridge that like the top of the range jobs, all the bottles, gas, full electric hookup, the leisure batteries with sockets and inverter in there, the rock and roller bed so you can sleep in it, pull it down. It's got pimped out with speakers in the back, all LED lighting, superb job, windows on both sides. It's a 2011 T5 transporter with 125,000 miles on the clock, full VW service history. It's going to be around £18,000 approximately. I've seen some 2 years older up for 19k with the same mileage as mine. From people I've spoke to, they seem to be going for about 18 grand. That's what I'm looking for, roughly. If that's a bargain, then so be it. But the van stands me in at that. And I've had some fantastic trips in it this summer. So, if you are interested, then message me on Facebook. It's black as well, so it looks pretty tricky. There are pictures on my Facebook. And I'll bang the full advert. I'm going to put it on eBay on Monday. It's just having a wheel bearing done on Monday morning, which is what I've been waiting for before I could put this out. But yes, 12 months MOT, and it's an extremely good carp wagon or general all-round vehicle. And I've got a driveway awning as well that I paid £500 for. I'll probably throw that in as well because I won't need it anymore. I'm going to buy a bigger van next year and just have a car for the winter. So yeah, sorry about that. Carp talk, we mentioned already that there's details of the new and bigger Scottish record in there. You can get the Carp Talk on Saturday digitally, which is 3 days early from the printed version. It's a bumper issue this month, isn't it, Mark? So they do it 3 or 4 times a year, one to look forward to. It's available from pocketmags.com. You can view it on your Apple, Android or PC device. It's only $2.49 for the bumper issue, and the printed version comes out on Tuesday, and it's $2.99. The stock is located on the Carp Talk website. If you want to find out where to buy a copy, go into your local newsagents and order it, and they'll get it in for you. Or have a look on their website, as I said. And now, what's in it this week, Mark? What are the highlights?
a ton of big fish as usual. I'm just looking around. We've got Ashmead. That fish is mint. That is like a new penny, single scale. One called Dave, you know that one?
I do know.
Colin over at St Ives. And my old mate Ed Bettridge has been at one. He's had Monk's Pit, the bigger there, at £49.
Yeah, his second session or something, wasn't it?
No, he's had a few sessions there, but I also know he's not been on there too long. He's caught quite a few fish. And that's a place I wouldn't mind a play on. Hopefully next year. Anyway, that's enough about me. And then you've got the Scottish record, and that's just interesting. You know, if you like me and like your history and all that, we also examine what is the oldest carp in the UK at the moment. What do you think that could be?
Ooh, not sure, but it must be 60 years old.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time it was thought to be one called Raspberry and Redmire, but I believe that one's gone. I'm going to read that, because honestly I've not got a clue.
There's a free gift as well this week in the 100-page bumper issue. You get a sample pack of Mainline's new essential cell toppers, which I'm assuming are toppers for snowmany stuff, which are all the rage. I'm a bit gutted because I caught so many fish on snowman baits 15 years ago. I've used them ever since, and now everybody's using them. Leave me on rig. Dave Levy's in there. He talks real-life carping. Craig Ellis explains how he's been so successful on the pressured circuit waters, and Andy Murray's in there as well for his first time in 15 years to talk particles.
Is he not carrying off his tank test series? Do you remember that?
No, I thought he'd been busy playing tennis for a while, but he's obviously got back into his carping.
Oh, it's different Andy Murray. That's the Mardy Scottishman, and you've got Andy Murray the Yorkshireman who did. This is back in Crafty Carper. I think it was a 482 part series of tank tests he did. With just about everything being thrown into a tank and an article written about it.
Oh, I did not. No, I've never seen that. That's interesting.
It was famous.
Crowy's in this week's edition as well. It makes the most of the late summer sunshine, bags the biggest fish in the lake, as Simon Crow usually does, and there's a competition. As I say every week, it hurts me if it's somebody other than a Carpcast listener that wins these competitions, because I want our lot scooping it all. And there's 1,300 quid's worth of prizes to give away in this time, including Fox R Series chairs, British Aquafees liquids, and a massive Corda 24 bundle. So get on the Carp Talk this week. It's a bumper edition. If you only buy a few a year, you've got to buy this one. That's it from us. It's been a reasonably long episode. Rob Hughes and Lee Jackson. We'll be back with listeners' questions. We've got a few. We've got some car paint sheep. All our old features are back in next week. So until then,
my visit on the bank with Julian Cundiff just after his mega session he had on his local syndicate, which was an interesting carpy chat, which went off of one or two tangents. That's what I'll say about that,
don't we? We like a tangent.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it from us. Until next time, see you later.
See ya.
Check out the website at www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.